All participants, today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. You may begin.
Thank you. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening to everyone. On today's call, we have Avery Doria, Mr. Papik, Evan Leibovich, Chuck Gomes, John Nevitt, Robin Gross. On staff, we have Margie Milam, Linda Saint-Géry, and myself, Gisela Gruber-White, and I don't have any apologies recorded. If I could just remind you to state your names when speaking for transcript purposes. Thank you. Over to you, Margie.
Okay. Well, thank you, everyone, for joining. I think I took a little bit of time and put together an agenda to get us started, and hopefully we can start off by selecting a chair of the drafting group. Does anyone want to volunteer or nominate a chair?
While people are thinking, this is Chuck, let me just comment. I didn't volunteer for this group. I tried in my co-chairing responsibilities with the community working group to really stay back and let the group do it, and I would like to do the same thing here. To the extent that I can be helpful, I will be helpful, but it would be very good if one of the people that volunteered would volunteer to take the leadership. I think all that means in this case is that you're going to keep things going and provide the leadership that's needed in that regard.
This is Evan. I would do it in a heartbeat if I hadn't been co-opted into like three other things in the last week. I don't know what the energy constraints are beyond the call itself. Are you just looking for people to move the call along, or does it include lot of inter-call work?
Well, I think, first of all, I think we're talking about maybe a couple calls and lots of work online. So, and Margie, correct me if you think I'm wrong, but obviously we identified last week that there are some differences of understanding, and the task of this group is simply to try and clarify those, to prepare a draft that would provide clarification that would ultimately be approved or edited by the full working group. So I would hope that in today's call we get a good start in terms of having mutual understanding among ourselves, and then can design a plan to come up with a first draft and then tweak it and give it to the full working group, maybe a week and a half from now. Does that make sense in other people's understanding?
It does. Chuck, put it this way. This is Evan again. There's been an awful lot of discussion started within the ALAC, for instance, on a response to the applicant guidebook. And so I'm in a little bit of a quandary to what extent we can count on having anything that we do now being sort of re-put back into the DAG in short order, or is this going to be a longer-term thing?
Well, I'm not sure I understand the question, Evan. My understanding is that in the message from Margie, she identified some areas where there were discrepancies, or maybe I should say a gap between staff understanding of the Rec 6 recommendations and what I think most of us that participated in the working group understood. So all we're really talking about here is making sure there's clear understanding between the working group and staff in terms of the recommendations. I mean, we shouldn't be getting into public comments and the overall draft. We have a pretty narrow focus here, as I understand it. Does anybody understand it differently?
This is Evan again, and I'll just go back to the comments that I've been hearing within ALAC. The reception to the draft DAG has been so severe that there were positions that were taken within people within the working group that may not be so relevant anymore. And I'll be very specific on one particular case. The role of the independent objector was controversial in the original release, was modified in the recommendation of this working group, and then, however, after seeing what had happened in the last version of the DAG, the ALAC basically wants to come out and say to nuke the IO entirely.
Okay.
The gap has widened rather than narrowed as a result of what's happened over the last couple of weeks.
But that's not what the focus of this little drafting team should be. The focus on this drafting team should be to do our best to clarify what was recommended by the community working group. To the extent that those recommendations may have changed in some people's minds, that's not our issue on this
Understood.
Drafting team. Does that make
okay.
sense?
Yeah. Yeah.
The goal isn't to restart the community working group on this. The goal is to make sure that there's understanding between staff who are working on the implementation of the new GTLD program and what was intended by the community working group.
Then can I ask staff, assuming that this group does what it does, is there a likelihood that there could be a response to this in time for Cartagena in terms of actual changes to the deck?
Then it's Margie. I don't think I can answer that. I'm not on the implementation team, and I don't know what the timeline is for responding to changes.
So we could do our darndest here and it not show up at all?
Well, we shouldn't assume, and I can't speak for staff either, and even less so than Margie can, but we shouldn't assume that some adjustments couldn't be made after Cartagena. I think we're going to be doing good in this with this drafting team to get something out maybe next week for the full community working group to review and make sure it's accurate representation of the report. And so we're going to be doing good to get it out in time for Cartagena because we're running into Cartagena at the end of next week. So you know, I don't want to take leadership, but I see Richard and Aubrey's hands up, so let's let them jump in. Richard?
Yeah, thanks, Chuck. This is Richard. So I wanted to agree that I think our mission is to do exactly what you said, that's to reconcile our recommendations with staff understanding and interpretation of those. And so I agree it's a pretty limited role for us, I think. To take an example, Kevin mentioned the independent objector. I don't think we had consensus. I think we had a divergent point of view on the independent objector. So I don't think that this group is really discussing that issue again. Rather, like discussing initially the 3 points that Archie raised in her email and any other points of sort of differing interpretation from what we wrote in our report.
Thanks, Richard. Aubrey?
Yeah, hi. I think I'm going to disagree just a little. I certainly agree that we're not here to re-argue the conclusions of the Rec 6. So insofar as something we didn't have consensus on before, we're not going to come here and start arguing towards consensus. However, going slightly beyond understanding, on those things where the group had consensus, I think that we can go beyond just making sure that they understand that consensus, but actually try to convince them of those things that we had consensus on. So it's a little bit more than just explanatory, but it's certainly not redoing anything. But on those points where we had consensus or even full consensus, I do think it's not only explaining it to the staff, it's arguing for it. Thanks.
Yeah. And I don't have any problem with that, Ari. I'm comfortable with that. I think that fits into what I intended, you know, or what I thought. I shouldn't say intended. What I thought the task was. And I think I would guess that staff would welcome that as well. So no volunteers to take the leadership.
Chuck, it's Margie. John volunteered in the chat.
Oh, okay. You know how terrible I am at looking at chat. So thanks. Is anybody opposed to John doing it?
Well, John was also opposed to him doing it. So John better speak up.
I'm willing to have someone else do it, and if that's considered a back-ended way to volunteer. That's, you know, we need to get it done, and I'm happy to do it. I'm happy to have someone else do it as well.
So any other volunteers? Any opposition to John taking the lead on this? Done. Welcome, John.
Thanks, Chuck, I think.
Yeah, I think, I understand that. It's all yours, John. Do you want to take it from here?
Do you have any recommendations on how you would envision going forward? I didn't have a conversation with, obviously, you or Margie before this.
Yeah, well, I think that I'm sure that you will take up. I mean, it might be helpful if we identify what's really. It seems to me there's one major issue, and maybe we should start off by letting Margie just quickly, not reading her whole email, but identify what the areas that staff has requested clarification on. And it seems to me that one of those is a very significant one, and that's the one that has gotten some attention on the list. But would that work, John, just to have Margie kind of, let's start there, and then let's see which one's the most important and deal with it first.
Sounds perfect.
Okay, sure. I'll explain it. I won't read the email. And you guys may remember from all last Monday. Essentially, I think that the issue that the implementation team had with the report was really trying to understand what the role of the board was, or at least intended from the working group report. Because as we read the report, or not me, but as staff read the report, they thought that what the working group was saying was that every single objection was to be decided by the board. And that seems to contradict what the instructions from the board have been to staff with regard to the recent resolution that talks about the role of the board being one where it's overseeing the process, but it's not actually deciding particular TLD strings. It's a scaling issue and whatever other issue that they considered in reaching that resolution. So that's one area where I think we really would like some clarification on, is to understand, you know, given the board resolution that has instructed staff what its role should be, how should this report be interpreted, and is there, you know, and did we misunderstand what the report said?
And were there other issues, Margie?
On that point, or
no, just in your total email.
Oh yeah, there's other issues. That's the main issue, and so. In particular, the board role and also the role of experts. I think there's a difference between what the board viewed as the role of experts and what the court and the working group viewed, because the board would like to rely on the determination of experts as opposed to having to be a decider of fact or adjudicate some sort of dispute. So that's the first issue. The second issue, I think, was related to the expansion of the discrimination standard. There was a suggestion in the report to include other protected classes, and from at least from what I understand, the staff concern was is that they did a fair amount of research on what is, you know, universally protected across the world, and they felt that expanding the criteria to include these additional classes made the whole criteria too broad and would bring in a lot of additional objections that we're seeing as problematic, because they might be infringing on free speech. It might make the whole objection process unworkable. So that's kind of like the second area regarding questions that the staff had on this topic. And then I think the last one had to do with the recommendations related to the GAC and the at-large committee, ALAC, to be able to bring objections. And staff, at least on the implementation side, didn't understand what criteria would be used, whether it would require a unanimous decision in that committee versus, you know, one member. Is it intended to provide a veto? I think there was, you know, they wanted more clarification on how what the working group expected with respect to that recommendation if it were to be adopted. And really, when we came up with this list, it was just a list of things that we identified in reviewing the report, but we, the implementation staff, they believe that there's probably other areas that there's a disagreement as to what the report said, and was hoping that this group, you guys, could identify other areas if there were other areas. Does that make sense?
Yeah, there are questions. Let's take them one at a time. The first issue, I guess, is probably the media. So that's the role of the board and the role of experts. Aubrey?
No, I put up my hand before you put special questions. I was going to bring up another issue that I think we had to do, but I guess I'll wait till later.
That's fine. Why don't we go there?
Okay. I think we talked a little bit when Evan was talking about ALAC's desire to eliminate the IO. What I looked at, and one of the things I don't see clearly on our list, is I think when we wrote a notion, when we were dealing with the notion of an IO, there was transparency in it. And all of a sudden, they've produced an IO that is, you know, once again, this secret thing ripe for abuse as opposed to an open and transparent thing. So I think that there's an issue in that needs to be explored at some point. This is beyond ALAC's desire to eliminate it. My view is more of it's there, but it needs desperate fixing. So I think that's an issue that needs to be dealt with.
So we had divergence on the issue of modifications to the role of IO in 10.1.
Yep.
So are you suggesting that – so it's not really a clarification of our CDP?
Well, I think it may be. I think, you know, and we maybe need to go back and understand, because I don't – while we had divergence on how it could be used and all that, I don't believe that we had divergence on its transparency or secrecy.
Yeah, I don't think we're
– I think we all assumed transparency. Maybe I'm forgetting something.
It may be an assumption, but we never polled on that issue.
Exactly. And so I know certainly that my assumption was that it was a transparent function, not that it was something that was being done in secret. And I think if we went back to our conversations, you know, that would certainly be something that came out. It's certainly something that needs to be talked about. I'm not trying to to predicate the conclusion of it. I think, though, one thing we should be aware of is that as a transparent thing, there may be some benefit and some, you know, saving grace that keeps the mandated ALAC request for it to be completely canceled a little less dangerous. So, you know, I'm just saying it's one of the topics I think needs to be on the table to talk about.
Okay. What other issues, in addition to independent objector? Any, Robin, you have one, it looks like?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, I just wanted to bring up the issue of incitement plus instigation. It seemed in the staff's report that they didn't seem to try to understand that the group was actually requiring a two-pronged test of there has to be incitement and there has to be instigation in order for the objection to go forward. It seemed like the staff seemed to not get that. They seemed to think that, you know, we just wanted incitement and we were just throwing in an extra word to be fanciful or something. But no, actually, we meant that there because we wanted to heighten the burden, make it more difficult to bring an objection. So that was intentionally in there, and it just seems like, you know, staff thought it was an accident and it was actually there intentionally. So we need to have some discussion about the standard of incitement plus instigation.
That's issue 5. It's that looks like, Richard, to your question on the chat, it looks like incitement was in our 7.1, our recommendation number 7.1. Okay. Any other, Evan?
One thing, I guess, that was very core to a lot of why I even got involved in this was the whole issue of the DRSP. And I think we have a major gap between what we envisioned to be a replacement process for what was the DRSP and what staff still believes needs to be there. You'll notice explicitly the term DRSP never shows up once in the recommendation. And I believe, at least in my personal point of view, that was deliberate. Yes, there is a need to have experts, but no, the envisioning of the working group as I saw it was far, far different from the concept of the DRSP. And explicitly, the letter R, the fact that the experts are not there to resolve anything. They're there to give advice. They're there at most to say to the board, do this, don't do this, based on an objective analysis. And the whole point of having a group that is called a dispute resolution service provider implies that there is a third party that is actually resolving things. And the working group, in many points, in many of the recommendations, had mapped out an explicitly different result to this. And to me, that is the biggest single gap that we have.
Okay, so that's related to the first issue, that we've identified the role of the board and the role of the experts.
I take it a step further because I'd expand it to the role of the DRSP, which continues to be in the DAG, even though the working group mapped out an alternative.
Richard.
Yeah, thanks. It's Richard. Yeah, so I agree. This is really, to me, this is all part of issue one. And, I don't think there was uniformity in the group on what Evan's suggesting. I, for example, wouldn't go so far in terms of specificity or prescriptiveness in terms of this whole DSRP thing. But I think that's what we've got to discuss. What is the role of this group? What constitutes their advice and recommendations? And what should the board do about it? That's the key issue in front of us, and I think that's all part of issue number one.
And also, to a smaller extent, even who they are. I mean, there were certain people, I'm not one of them, but there were certain people that even disliked the way that the DRSP was chosen and the criteria on which they were chosen. I mean, that all still relates to this, but there's all these tiny little side issues that flow from it.
Yeah, and this is Richard again, John. Just quickly, to me it's important that we to our mission here, which I think is to clarify what the group said, where it had consensus. I think some of the issues that are coming up here we did not have consensus on, so I don't know that we're going to, I don't know the function of this group is going to be to try and re-examine those issues. I think it's the ones where we did have consensus. Is there a different interpretation on the staff's part from what's in our minds?
Okay. Chuck?
Yeah, I just want to reinforce what Richard's saying. I think we could go off and work for weeks if we start, examining the various views of different people in the group. I personally think we would be most productive if we focus on those areas where there was consensus and full consensus and making sure, first of all, from Marge's point of view, that she understands, and then that we can draft a statement that'll be helpful to the whole implementation team.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we're not in disagreement. I'm fully confident that the points that I was trying to make can be done based on what achieved consensus.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know if it'd be helpful for folks, for Margie maybe to talk about, it sounds like we're getting into the first issue, talk about the different recommendations that relate to the role of the board and the role of the DRSP or the experts. I note that 4.6, the name of the process where we actually talked about the dispute resolution process, did not have consensus but strong support. And then 11.2 had full consensus, and there we talk about the dispute resolution process for sooner in the process to minimize costs. I don't know if there are other recommendations that actually dispute. I think it would be helpful maybe for Margie to highlight those based on these five issues. Maybe we can color-code it. The issues will talk, have a better sense of what we actually said in the first round. Margie, I see your hands up. And then Robin.
Yeah, I had a hand up for a different issue. In talking to implementation staff and trying to understand where the gap was, I can share a couple things. One of them, if you don't mind me pulling up the explanatory memorandum, might help explain some of the reasoning behind why the recommendation or the applicant guidebook was developed the way it was. with the one issue that, that comes to mind is the DRSP. So it's kind of the first issue. But one of the problems that they seemed to have when they were trying to understand the report was that the GNSO Council, when it came up with the new GTLD recommendations, included a recommendation that there be that these objections be resolved through a dispute resolution procedure. So I think that's one of the areas that they had a hard time grappling with what to do with the report when the GNSO Council had recommended that these type of objections be resolved through a dispute resolution process. And Chuck, I don't know if you remember, I wasn't really involved with the council at that time, the background behind that guideline or recommendation.
Yeah. Well, certainly that was a recommendation, and I think that staff did follow that. Now, I don't recall us, and Aubrey probably can help in this as well, but I don't recall us really getting into the semantics of what the independent experts would be, at least not focusing on that, you know, whether we call it a dispute resolution provider or a panel of experts. I don't think that was so much of an issue, or at least not one that was directly talked about in the CDP process. The point was that there were going to be these panels that that would objectively, and that was another recommendation of the GNSO, objectively make a decision with regard to whether the decision or a recommendation, however that's handled, with regard to the complaint that was filed.
Hey, Robin.
Thanks. Yeah, I wanted to raise another point about the independent objector, and one of the things that the group, the cross community working group, recommended was that there be an actual party who's willing to say, I'm going to be harmed by this TLD that's going forward, before the independent objector can bring a complaint forward. And this was something that we did because we saw it as a mechanism to protect against abuse and to maintain some kind of accountability in the proceedings by having an actual party who will say, yes, I'm willing to be responsible. I'm willing to be the one to say this shouldn't go forward, rather than, you know, just some quiet process. So that was something that the group, the cross-community working group, built into the recommendations. And when the staff came out with this proposal that says we're not going to accept any of the modifications to the IO, this is another one of those protections against abuse that the group worked in that is now being taken out by staff.
Hey, Robin, where did our group work that in? Just, you know, because if it's a clarification point, then we should.
Yeah, let me find the exact rec, and I'll post that.
Helpful.
Yeah.
Okay, Chuck?
Yeah, I'd just like to suggest that we stay on task. Let's focus on the first one, the biggest one, and then let's go through the others. And when we get to the IO, let's talk about the IO. If we keep jumping around, our progress is going to be very limited.
Yeah, that's fair. That's a fair point. Thank you. Aubrey, hopefully on the first issue.
Yeah. Yeah, it was on the dispute. We're talking about the dispute resolution. Is that okay? I think, and we're going back to what the council, and this doesn't necessarily fit with perhaps everything I'm advocating at the moment, but nonetheless, the council was certainly very strongly against anything that turned out to be beauty contestless and therefore left decisions in the board's hands. And it was very intent on there being decision procedures. However, that was not in the recommendations. That was in the implementation guidelines. And the implementation guidelines are just that. They are guidelines. So the recommendations do not say all decisions will be made by dispute resolvers. That's in a guideline. What the requirements say is that there'll be a predetermined process that declares exactly so you know what you're going to go through. In the guidelines, it's more into, and decisions will be made by external dispute resolution. I have it in front, you know. So that's something to be careful in making that differentiation, because the council at the time was careful about making that differentiation, is that the requirements were the policy, the principles were the policy, the guidelines were aids that the staff was supposed to work from. So to say that the staff followed the guidelines is completely true. To say that the guidelines are inviolable policy is not true. Thanks.
Does that mean we don't need a four-month communications period? All right. Next is Richard.
Thanks, John. So, yeah, I mean, to issue number one, I'm sort of struggling, I guess, a little bit like the staffer, I think, to understand where we've diverged from what the applicant guidebook says. I think we had consensus on two recommendations in Section 4. One says that the ultimate responsibility, ultimate resolution rests with the board, and as the staff have noted, that's what the guidebook says. And then our second one was that the board can choose to have independent experts. And we call them the DRSP, or we call them the Glee Club. I don't think it matters. They're a group of experts who are going to give advice, and then ultimately the board makes the decision. So I'm not understanding the divergence within this group on 4.1 and 4.2. But they don't say to me that there can't be a group of people who make a recommendation. That's not what I voted for in that. But maybe I'm misinterpreting this. I don't see where 4.1 and 4.2 vary from what the staff are saying. But perhaps someone could clarify that for me.
Anyone want to clarify that for Richard?
Where is the rule of the DRSP in actually resolving anything? Why does that even need to be there?
Well, you're raising a question. I'm being very specific here.
You're asking me in the gap. We're suggesting that, according to the recommendations, this is what the recommendations suggest should be, and I want to know why there's a necessity to have something called the DRSP implement that.
I don't think we made a recommendation that there would not be a DRSP, though.
We made a recommendation for a process. The process does not involve experts doing dispute resolution.
But could you point to the recommendation that says that?
Sorry, I'm trying to get to it. It says what they do. It doesn't say what they don't do. Okay? I mean, we didn't get into a whole pile of negative things. We got into a recommendation that says this is what the experts will do. Do you see anything in the recommendations that say that the experts will do dispute resolution? Can you find that for me?
Yeah, we're talking about 4.2, correct?
No, can you tell me if there's any recommendation anywhere in the document that says that the experts will perform dispute resolution?
Yeah, 4.2. Well, it depends what you mean by dispute resolution.
No, those words.
Okay, I'm not...
Do the words dispute resolution occur anywhere in the recommendations?
Yes.
You say yes,
sorry,
John?
I don't have it in front of me right now, but I don't recall that that was done.
11.2 refers to the dispute resolution process for Rec 6 objections should be resolved sooner in the process to minimize costs.
Okay, but that refers to the entire process from beginning to end, not to one specific body's participation in it. There's nothing saying that there's experts engaging in dispute resolution.
Can I jump in here, John?
Yeah, sorry, Chuck. Go ahead.
No, that's okay. I may be off, but this seems an awful lot of just semantics to me. Now,
it's important semantics to a lot of people, Chuck.
I understand that, but let me finish, okay? What I'm getting at, a complaint is filed to an application that was made. Some people would automatically say that that's a dispute between the applicant and the complainant. And the idea of the expert panel would be to try to come to some sort of a recommendation with regard to that. Let me ask you, Evan, is the concern that it says resolve the dispute? It's not the word dispute that's bothering you, I don't think. Is it the resolving, the resolution word is that is the problem?
Yeah, pretty well.
Okay.
And here's maybe the fine line of this that really worried a lot of people is the idea that the experts are doing more of an objective research. Does this contravene law? As opposed to a dispute resolution, which people think of as two people going in front of an arbitrator that judges one over the other.
Yeah.
And we saw a very deliberate and hoped for a very deliberate movement from one to the other.
Okay.
The idea that both complainant and the original applicant were going to have to pay money jointly to a dispute resolution provider, that they were going to have to pay for the provider in order to judge between them, was fundamental to the problems that we had with this.
Yeah, and let me come back then and say, sorry if I cut you off, but let me come back and say, when I say that I think it's a semantical issue, isn't necessarily contrary to what your concern is. If it is just a semantical issue, then I think it's an easy fix maybe for the implementation team. Just with different words, we could avoid the perception that this expert panel is doing any sort of final resolution, okay? They're going to make a recommendation rather than resolve anything.
But,
and if that solves the concern, that's not a hard fix.
Okay. But are you with me and am I out in left field when I'm suggesting that it's not semantic but a significant difference that the experts are expected to do an objective evaluation against international law as opposed to a subjective judgment between two parties? We saw that as being a significant...
I am with you, and I think Aubrey pointed that out in terms of what the PDP working group actually, recommended. So, yeah, I'm with you on that.
Margie, how are you with that?
I'm sorry. I guess I don't understand. I'm a little lost right now. I don't understand.
Well, that's why we're here.
what you're saying, and from my conversations with the implementation staff, they very much do look at it as a resolution process where there are two parties, there is an adjudication. They look at it as a different animal.
Okay, then Chuck, you can see that's where our gap is. That's where a significant gap is.
So, Evan, let me ask you a question, if you don't mind. And I see a couple people are raising their hands, too, so maybe this helps clarify. But would you envision, we had full consensus on the fact that the board shall contract with appropriate expert resources provide objective advice, right?
Absolutely correct.
Okay, so then the question is, would you have the applicant and the objector submit something?
No.
And submit any argumentation, submit their rationale for why they think an objection should be held or not to the expert advisors?
Well, I'll tell you what I envisioned, and in fact, in working out my own process with this, I in fact designed myself a little flow chart that I think some of you have seen that essentially said an objector puts forward their documentation. They are never touched again. So in other words, they put forward their documentation, and they do it once. They put it forward either to staff, the GAC, or the ALAC, who then perform a quick look. If that quick look succeeds, then it goes to the expert. The original documentation goes to the experts. That's it. And there is no further appearance by the applicant or by the objector. That original documentation is all that's there. The role of the experts is to examine the documentation. Is it in line with international law? Is it not in line with international law? Pass that recommendation to the board.
Would the applicant have a right to respond to the objection?
In writing at the very beginning, perhaps, but that's it. At the time that the application is first submitted, they both get one ability to make a statement, and then they are out of the process.
And what's the rationale for having them out of the process?
First of all, reduced expense. Secondly, reduced opportunity for gaming. And thirdly, overall, reduced complexity. Oh, by the way, we also don't have a third party having to make an ethical judgment between competing moralities. And in fact, instead replace that with an objective, is this in line with international law, is a very different question than is your right to have this better than my right to have that.
Oh, we have a queue building up.
At least am I answering your questions?
You definitely answered my question. We could talk about whether there's agreement with that rationale or not, or if that's what the...
Again, I'm just trying to go by what the working group thought they were agreeing to.
Which working group? You're talking about the...
How about the CWG?
Oh, okay.
The CWG said the panel of experts will do an evaluation against international law. It's not evaluating the respective rights of two advocates. It's taking an objection and says, is this in line with law?
Right. We certainly didn't say, though, that we wouldn't hear from the two parties throughout the process. Right?
We didn't say we would.
Right. Okay,
we didn't say that was a necessary part of this.
Okay, let me go through the queue, Evan, because we've got four hands up. We've got Margie.
Sure. My comment was on a different issue. Back to what Aubrey said about the guidelines that the GNSO Council forwarded to the board and this discussion of having a DRSP as part of that. One of the and Chuck, you can recognize this issue. One of the concerns we've had as staff is how do you take this community report, given that it wasn't endorsed by the GNSO Council in any way, and take that whatever's in this report and have it trump what was endorsed by the GNSO Council in the recommendation, when they did all their implementation guidelines. It's this weird, we haven't really, I guess bylaws or organizational standpoint, put structure around what is a community working group report and what impact does it have and how does it flow through our policy processes. So I just wanted to raise that issue because I heard it from implementation staff, and it's one of the concerns they have when you take a recommendation that's in the report and it contradicts something that the GNSO Council already opined on or recommended,
John, can I respond to that since my name was mentioned?
Absolutely. Go ahead.
I guess my question to you, Margie, what in the report of the community working group contradicts what the GNSO PDP recommendations were? I left the work of the community working group thinking that we really didn't contradict anything, and staff is thinking there are contradictions. We need to identify where those contradictions are.
Sure, Chuck, if I may respond. It is in the difference between how you see these panels. It's exactly what Evan's raising versus what is in the applicant guidebook. And from what I understand, and again, this is from them, that they do see it as a real, type of arbitration where there's briefs and there's a decision, and the role of the resolution that dealt with the role of the board makes it clear that the board doesn't want to be making those kinds of decisions, having to read briefs, and they want to go through the process of having someone else do it because that is what they see the role of, not as an adjudicatory body, but simply setting up a process that's fair and everything is known up front. And so that's where the contradiction lies.
I need something more specific than that.
So the key...
I still don't know tell me what recommendation made by the GNSO and approved by the board is contradicted by what the community working group recommended. I'm not seeing it. I heard your general comments, but I need to know specifically because I still am not convinced that there is a contradiction.
If I may, Chuck, implementation guideline passed by the GNSO, H said, and I'm looking at the report, external dispute resolution providers will give decisions on objections. So, and then the question is one of clarification in my eyes, in whether, you know, our objections that actually had consensus contradicts that or not. I would take the position that they don't, but some of the ones that might have been recommended that didn't have consensus might contradict that, such as 4.6, and that one was process for recommendation 6 objections should not be referred as a dispute resolution process.
Right, yeah, but if we're looking at the consensus or the full consensus recommendations, I don't think there's a direct contradiction. I can understand it could have been understood that way, and, of course, that's the purpose of why we're meeting.
Right, and then we get to Aubrey's point of on the chat whether it's okay to contradict those or not.
I would also make the point, Evan butting in, but I just want to make the point that the whole reason why we have this as a community working group and not just as a PEDP is that the initiative actually came from the ACs, right? So you have ALAC and the GAC who were not part of that original process, who were not part of the development of Rec 6.
Well,
and this is the first. That's
their own doing. Let's be careful there, okay? They were certainly invited and welcome to be a part of that process.
But they weren't.
And there were ALAC people involved.
Right. Okay. All right. Let me go on the queue because some people have been waiting very patiently. Konstantinos.
Yes. Are we still on the DRSP issue? Hello.
Sorry. Go ahead.
Yes. Are we still on the DRSP issue? On, you know, versus having experts. The point that I wanted to raise, and actually it takes us back to what Evan is saying, is that there is a huge difference that potentially can go even beyond semantics. If we have a DRSP, a dispute resolution provider, it means that, look at the UDRP, you have certain criteria that you need to prove, and then the decision of the panel is final. ICANN does not challenge it and cannot challenge it. The whole idea of this working group, when we were making the recommendations to remove even any reference to the dispute resolution system, is that we don't want someone making final determinations if that someone is not the board. So if you have a dispute resolution provider, you need to have criteria, and we go back to the original argument that you cannot set criteria to judge morality and public order. So I think that this wasn't the understanding of the group at the time, that if you have a DRSP, you need to have solid criteria. You cannot have solid criteria under international law. So this is another reason why the dispute resolution provider should not be part of this process. Thank you.
Just one point, because you came in a little late. What we decided as our charter, for lack of a better term, I don't know if we had consensus on this, but was that the role of this group is to come up with any clarifications of our consensus positions to the extent that in the staff report and in the DAG and then the other report, whatever we called it, the explanatory memorandum, were there any clarifications or misinterpretations of that? Obviously, we discussed the point you just made a fair amount during the discussion of the CWG, and that did not achieve consensus. So the question is, did the staff misinterpret that or not? And that's what we're trying to focus on, because we only have a week and a half to do this, apparently. Richard.
Thanks, John. It's Richard. So I understand what Evan and Konstantinos are describing there. It's their interpretation of 4.1 and 4.2, and I understand the arguments that they're making. I would point out that I don't think 4.1 and 4.2 are as explicit as they're saying. If they had been as explicit as what they're saying, then I wouldn't have voted for them, because that's a far more specific and prescriptive thing than what I actually voted for in 4.1 and 4.2. I think what 4.1 and 4.2 say now is pretty simple, that the board can choose to appoint experts, the experts can give advice, and then the board must make a decision based on that advice. They can accept it or reject it. To me, that's all 4.1 and 4.2 are saying. I think it's pretty simple, and that's why I voted for it. If it was to get a lot more specific and prescriptive about the hows and the whys, I'm not sure we would have seen the same consensus for these two recommendations.
Okay, so let me just do a time check. What I thought we had an hour and a half for this call, but it, you know, I just looked at the note. It says 60 minutes. What are folks available to stay a little longer? Because we're right at 53 minutes now. It looks like any objection to extending a little bit this discussion?
I can go a little longer, but I might not be able to be here for the full 90.
So here, no objection other than Evan maybe having to drop off a little early, then we'll continue. So we've talked certainly about the DRSP. If there are other comments on that, we'll take them. But we also, to Richard's point on the chat, the role of the board. Is there any clarification that we need to the role of the board? And I guess our full consensus opinion was in 4.1, where we say the ultimate resolution of the admissibility of a TLD subject to a recommendation 6 objection rests with the board alone and may not be delegated to a third party.
There's another thing I think is relevant to this, and I don't want to discount it, and it's the parts of the recommendation that talk about the reference to international law. In other words, the validity of an objection to international law, as I read these recommendations, trumps everything. It trumps whether or not an applicant is advocating that they are being offended or something is being infringed, that the one and the primary goal of the experts is to evaluate an objection against international law, not against two different parties making a dispute. And I saw that as a significant part that I would add in this section one as being as important as anything else. It is not just that we have experts. We've also been very clear what we want these experts to do. We want these experts to match objections against international law. We do not want them matching against comparative morality.
Which recommendation is that?
All the references to international law. I don't have it in front of me, but I can scroll to it. It shouldn't be too hard to find.
Well, that's consistent with the recommendations of the GNSO. And we did that with all of the expert panels, to use the term that people like better. They were supposed to be based on principles of international law in all cases, whether that be rights protections or the recommendation 6 issues, et cetera. So I don't think we need to debate that. I mean, that's consistent with the recommendations of the GNSO originally.
The reason I was raising this, Chuck, is to bring it in context of the conversation of the DRSP, that what is it that the experts are being asked to do? And it was my understanding as we had our conversations that the primary rule of the experts is to validate an objection against these principles of international law.
And I agree with you.
And we didn't include anything else, meaning we didn't include somebody's sense of offense. We explicitly excluded any one particular country citing its own national law in the absence of international agreement. So we even went to some steps to explicitly say, this is not about who's offended. This is not about whose toes are getting stepped on. The one criteria that the experts are being called upon to assess is applicability to international law,
advocacy. What has staff done in the implementation plan that goes counter to that?
Well, you know what? Let's hold off on that because I see that as we're talking about criteria number 5, incitement and instigation, and that seems to be more of a criteria type discussion. So, you know, whether the DRSP or the board, let's finish this one out if we can, and then move to the others quickly.
Yeah. Well, it's wrapped into the issue of what do the experts do?
Yeah, I understand that. It's the criteria that the experts will evaluate an objection against. That's fine. At least I understand it that way.
And this is why I believe that it wasn't necessary to have a process in which you had briefs going back and forth. Essentially, here's the objection. Is it consistent with international law? Yes or no.
Right. And I guess any other international law discussion on in the World Court, for example, would be fully briefed by the parties. So I guess that's the cognitive leap I'm missing in your argument.
Because we're not trying to make law. We're just trying to say, does it apply to the objection?
But you're saying, right, okay. So I think we understand the positions on the DRSP, and we'll figure out, you know, next steps with that. The second of number one
hey,
was...
John, before you go on, I had my hand up there.
Oh, okay. Sorry, Chuck.
That's okay. Evan, I agree with you on your fundamental premise, but... just in evaluating principles of international law and whether they're violated in some sense, it may be helpful for there to be interaction between the parties. So I don't think we should rule that out. That shouldn't change what the role of the expert panel does. They may need to request clarification from one of the parties doesn't change their role to evaluate principles of international law, but it may help them do that fairly.
And I'm not disagreeing with that. I'm disagreeing with the principle that you have two parties coming up doing briefs and due ready to do battle and having to jointly pay for somebody to balance them out against each other.
Yeah, so we're in agreement there. I don't think we should... The one thing I objected to was the suggestion that there shouldn't be any other interaction between the expert panel.
I was oversimplifying it to try and draw a very clear distinction between that and the staff idea that this was a fully judicial process.
Yeah, okay. I think we're together now.
Okay, so we got the role of the board, role of the experts, at least we've had an initial...
Just one more thing on that, John. So are we, and this was discussed on the list in regard to this, is there agreement with the people on this call that, as was expressed by some on the list in the last few days, that if a recommendation came from the expert panel to honor an objection, in other words, to approve an objection, that should require a higher threshold by the board, and that is in the same area that we're talking about right now. I thought, and I didn't participate in any of the polls, but I thought that there was pretty good, pretty strong, in fact, a consensus agreement at least on that, that that's the area that a stronger threshold for the board was recommended.
Yeah, I'm looking at 5.1, which says a higher threshold of the board should be required to uphold an objection, but that did not get consensus.
Oh, okay. Thanks, John.
Assuming that happens, the higher threshold should be at least 2/3. That did get consensus.
But isn't it true that we, and I'm curious, people disagree with me if my assessment is wrong, isn't it true that the community working group wasn't necessarily recommending that the board do a specific review as if they were experts themselves on every one of these complaints, but ultimately the authority is theirs in the end? Is that a misstatement?
Richard? Not in my eyes. Richard, do you have...
No, that was exactly my understanding, Chuck, that there would be expert advisors. They would provide advice against the standard, which is a separate issue entirely. Whatever the standard is, they would provide advice against that standard, and the board would ultimately decide whether to accept or reject that advice. And I thought that's what 4.1 and 4.2 said. I did not interpret 4.1 and 4.2 to say that the board has to be the ones making the sort of detailed expert analysis of the merits of the case.
I agree. This is a matter of the board may have the last yes or no, but they've pushed off the details to somebody else. I don't think there is any disagreement on that. I think the disagreement was on whether or not the experts themselves would have the ability to uphold an objection without final board approval.
Margie, are you finding this helpful?
Yes, except for the fact that I think the board resolution states that they are not going to be reviewing application by application. So how do we, you know, I mean, and that's obviously a development since the report was issued, but in light of the fact that the board has basically said they will not be reviewing applications case by case, how do you, you know, where's the compromise or where's the, you know, how do you make that recommendation you know, work with the, what the board stated they
were
doing.
Are you saying that the board wouldn't look at the evidence in any case?
That's my understanding. And again, you know,
I didn't understand that, Margie.
I'm reading things slightly differently. I see that the board was presented with a scenario in which it was going to be asked to yes or no every single application. And based on that, of course, the board would say they didn't want to do that. I don't think that's what we're talking about here. We're talking about a very, very small number of applications that have passed the quick look and, in fact, have gone as far as going to the experts. And then the experts produce a report that the board can accept or reject. I don't understand the problem with that. This is a fundamental responsibility of ICANN's board. How can they say this is not our responsibility? This is exactly what the CWG said. It is. The buck stops there, not with the experts.
Okay, let me clarify. I agree that they've said that the buck stops with the board, so that this, whatever happens, it doesn't take away board responsibility. And I also agree that they didn't intend to approve every single application. It was a volume issue. So I don't know if there's some, you know, some smaller amount of things that may be able to go to the board or not. That I don't know.
Well, I think that's another one of the gaps, is that there was a perception by staff that the CWG was putting forward that every single application was going to be put forward this way, and I think that's absolutely. Is there anyone in this call that thought that was the intention? That's a major point, Margie. Is that the intention is that if this process gets done properly, then a very, very small number of applications are going to make it through the quick look to the experts and ultimately to the board. A very, very small number of applications, and I don't think it was considered to be too onerous to have the board have the final look on that.
Okay, so then maybe that's a clarification we would want to put in our...
Is anyone here disagree with me on that?
It's Margie. I think where I'll point to where the disagreement lied on the staff side. Recommendation 5.3 says that approval of a string should only require a simple majority of the board, regardless of the input from the experts. So recommendation 5.3, which was a consensus position, talks about the board approving, you know, even if there is no objection, so regardless of the input. So that's where at least my understanding is where the
Yeah, that said they could do that. That didn't obligate them to do it on every single application. It said the board through a simple majority could just say, yes, this thing goes through, the application, the objection fails, and we just let it through, and the board would have the ability to do that. We had a disagreement on whether or not there was a super majority necessary to uphold an objection, but we were trying to make the point that the board essentially could do this if it wanted. I don't think anyone had anticipated that this would be interpreted as an obligation by the board to look at everything.
Isn't that what they do already, Margie? They basically, I mean, even if they decided, made a decision to accept the recommendations of the expert panel, they would have to do that by at least a simple majority, right?
In the past, of my understanding, again, they're looking at a volume issue, and you know, you analogize what happens, say, with the registrar accreditation agreement, where the board sets up the process, you know, essentially set up the process, and then registrars are accredited, and the board doesn't get, you know, they don't approve blanket, you know, new registrars. It's just a process that gets implemented by staff. So
I think that's where the disconnect is. But if you know, if you guys are right and you're, you know, and that wasn't the correct interpretation of the working group report, I think that's a very useful clarification.
All we have to do is get somebody to write it up.
If you tell me what to write, I can write it.
Well, did this make sense? I mean, are you getting the gist? I think, you know, nobody's disagreeing with this, what we've been saying the last are you seeing it as clarification? Obviously, it has to be others as well, but...
Me? Yes. I do. This is Margie.
Do you think you could write it up and then we could we could just help edit it or something?
Sure.
Does that work, John?
That's perfect. Thank you. Okay. So with the remaining time, it would be great to talk about some of these others that were raised, certainly the two other ones in Margie's memo. One being the discrimination standard you talked about. You want to highlight that one again, Margie?
Okay.
We'll put it back on the screen.
Yeah, let me try that. Okay. I put it back up.
Number two.
This had to do with expanding the criterion to include additional protected classes. And the ones that I think raised a concern from the staff perspective are, you know, disability, gender, actual or achieved sexual orientation or identity, political or other opinion. And in the view, at least what's been discussed with me, is that adding that into the criteria makes it much broader and at least from the research that had been done in the past, there didn't seem to be support across the board internationally for expanding that, you know, for protection for all those categories. And so if you take a look, for example, even political or other opinion, that might actually rule out a number of very legitimate uses for TLD strings. So that, I think that's a concern from the staff perspective.
Okay, so the recommendation that we issued was that ICANN should seriously consider adding other treaties as examples. You're talking about 2.1? Is that where we are?
It's not the treaties. Yeah, I can pull up the exact one. And it's more the criterion.
John, what happened was, and if you look at 7.1, the second bullet, there were other categories that are added there that are not in the draft applicant guidebook.
I think it's 6.1 that we're specifically talking about.
6.1? Let me go back to that, yeah. Oh, yeah, right. Which is the...
7.1 and 7.1.
Yeah, it's both, yeah. It's the same wording. So I'm doing this from memory, so somebody help me out, and Aubrey probably can help out if she's still on, too, on this one, because she was one of the advocates of this, is that the actual or perceived sexual orientation or gender identity was added, political or other opinion was added. I don't know if there were any others. Those two specifically, if my memory is correct, please check me on that. Were added to what's in the guidebook right now.
Chuck, if I may, if you look at it, now, it's everything that's in the parentheses, I think, is the new material. When I drafted that email, I tried to reflect back at what it used to say.
Thanks.
The disability wasn't in...
Oh, right, that's right.
Okay, any discussion on this?
Well, just to help get discussion going, I'm not advocating one way or the other, but the I thought staff's point was interesting in that I thought that we were trying to limit the number of areas where strings would be challengeable, and that they're certainly right that adding these new categories would create more areas of concern. But the question comes back to what Evan was strongly advocating in our last in the main issue that we talked about first, and that is that are there principles of international law that relate to these that could legitimately be relied on by the expert panel? And I have no idea what the answer to that is.
Richard, and then hopefully Konstantinos could weigh in because he looks like he's weighing in on the chat.
Yeah, so reference to what Chuck just said, yeah, I think all of these things, Marge, are predicated on the notion that there has to be generally accepted legal principles, correct? So I think your point is that you don't think that there are generally accepted legal principles on some of these forms of discrimination, but if that's the case, then they'll fail. An objection on that basis would fail. So I don't know that it's harmful to put them in there, but I think, as with violent lawless action, et cetera, if the expert recommendation and the subsequent decision show that there aren't generally accepted principles regarding one of these forms of discrimination, then that objection is going to be unsuccessful. Does that make sense?
Chuck, or may I comment? John? I think the problem is there's no one central thing that this is international law and everyone agrees on it. It's a degree issue. It's how many countries, you know, address it in the same, you know, or similar way. And so it's not, I don't think it's as simple, Richard, as you may suggest, because they're because these and from what I understand, staff did a fair amount of research trying to find the appropriate place to draw the line. And they felt, or at least their experts that they consulted felt that there just wasn't, you know, a universal standard for these other areas, even though it may very well be protected in the United States, for example, or you know, other countries, but not, you know, across the board to the same degree as the ones that were proposed in the applicant guidebook.
So they would basically fail, but you're saying it would be sort of hard, it would be quite difficult to get to that judgment if you've already done the research and you know that they're going to fail already because there is no general principle of political opinion. Is that kind of what you're saying?
No, that's not what I'm saying, because if you include this, for example, as gender, then you have to give instructions on how it gets interpreted, and that's where it falls apart. Do you apply the U.S. standard? Do you, you know, I mean, it makes it far less clear-cut and uniform in application. At least that, I mean, you can certainly bring on Amy and Kurt to talk about this. I'm certainly not the expert in this, but that would be what I would anticipate the objection being if you were to expand it, is that there wouldn't be a uniform set of principles to apply in, you know, with these categories.
So, Evan?
At least I can give you the point of view I came in with, and that was the deliberate intention of having a very high bar to sustain an objection. And that was deliberate, that the idea being is that simply being against one single country's morality would not be enough to sustain an objection, that one particular community or one particular government in the absence of any others would be offended by something would not be sufficient to sustain an objection. And I think the intention of bringing in international law was, you know, the idea of having things like the UN Declaration of Human Rights as having defined, you know, these are things that we consider to be, you know, inalienable and part of this. There are some things that are there, and if they're not there and widely agreed upon, okay, then they're not necessarily part of our criteria. But
so that you would agree then that the experts would look at this and see if there's, you know,
they would see what applicable treaties are out there.
Right. So the question that staff's raising in this note, is there research suggesting that these additional classes are widely recognized around the world? I don't think we need to reach that answer. The question is, if there is today, or in a year from now, maybe there will be. Who knows?
And
but
this is, see, to me, this is the
which would advise to
such,
me,
this is the primary goal of the experts.
So, does that help a clarification of that point, Margie?
I can't answer that. I don't think it does for me personally, but again, I need to defer to Amy and Kurt because they're the ones that did this research and came to this conclusion. I don't, you know, not them personally, but they had the research conducted. So I think that's something I may have to follow up with them.
Right.
But Margie, there's also a fundamental issue here that, you know, staff gets driven by policy as opposed to drives policy. If there's research to be done along these lines, shouldn't it be in accordance with what the community would like to do, as opposed to coming out with the research to come up with some other goal and then saying to the community, this is what it is?
I mean, that's
a very different question, but as you're saying, you know, as you're raising that question, that's my answer to it.
Okay. All right, Richard?
Dropped off.
Okay. So, anything else on the discrimination standard or the...
I guess my only question, John, is where do we go from here? Is there any written clarification we need to define here? Should we, like, for example, make a statement like Richard made that, okay, if there's not principles of international law that apply, then the objection is going to fail. But then Margie, you know, pointed out some concerns that she understood from staff. So I'm just trying to get clarity in terms of where we go with this particular one in terms of providing clarification.
Okay, any, I see Margie and Evan's hands up. Margie?
Sure, and the other point, which I don't think we've really discussed, is, okay, I mean, especially coming from the U.S. perspective, I understand gender, you know, disability, sexual orientation, all that, you know, makes sense. But what about other opinion, you know, political or other opinion? I mean, setting aside whether we'll find standards and, you know, on those the other ones, that one seems a bit overly broad, and I wouldn't even know how to set up a standard for that or not, you know. So anyway, that was what I wanted to raise. And then, Robin, to address your concern, I believe that link there provides more information on the research that was conducted, and I can certainly check with Amy and Curtis if there's anything else.
But I think what you're hearing, Margie, though, is that this group shouldn't have to come up with some research. That the fact is that if there is any kind of body of international law that would apply, then it would apply to it would apply to these additional criteria. And if there's not, then it's not an issue. I think that's what Richard was saying.
And I'd like to take that one step further in saying that to me is the primary and overarching rule of the experts, not for us to define what specific treaties to look at, but to go to the experts, and the experts will, on a case-by-case and over time, saying these are what is applicable. Laws are going to change. New treaties could be made. Other things could be done. We can't anticipate everything today that's going to exist 2 years from now, and we can't keep changing this policy. The intention is to give the experts a very specific realm of saying, here's what you're allowed to examine. But within that realm, look at what's changed, look at what's new, look at what is being done on a dynamic basis, but still keep it to specific issues of international law. We can limit the bounds while at the same time recognizing that we don't have to give a detailed list of everything that's in those bounds.
Okay. All right, we've got just a couple of minutes. Richard?
Yeah, I just want to quickly remind everyone what the staff have said on that particular one. That we are, by including those additional classifications, we are increasing the ability of a string to be successfully objected to. Just wanted to remind everyone of the outcome of us heading down this path.
I disagree with that interpretation.
Well, if a particular class, if it was limited to only the forms of discrimination that are in the DAG, other forms of discrimination would not be the grounds for rejecting. But if we...
Yes, but... this is Konstantinos, but at the same time, we cannot really turn our backs on the fact that there might actually be discrimination on the basis that we're afraid that more objections will be raised. And just the only point that I would like to make is that because I hear us all referring to generally accepted principles of international law, they are not such things. Basically, international law operates on the basis of historical facts. The treaties that we have now address issues that happened years and years ago and the international community decided to address. And Evan's point is right on spot. We cannot foresee what will happen in 2 years' time. And that feeds back to the whole idea of the experts. So you know, international law and the way it is interpreted operates on a case-by-case basis in most of the cases, apart from those ones that are so obvious that treaties have been drafted and have been made. Because we have to remember that a treaty takes 10 years to be drafted. So it is impossible to have treaties to cover every single issue.
Okay, so it sounds like we're losing some people. There's no one in the queue right now. So I know that there's the third issue in the letter that ICANN or Margie put together, or the talking points related to the GAC and ALAC objections, and then we have the independent objector issue, and then the incitement and instigation issue. So we have three more issues. We're obviously not going to get to them in the next 5 minutes. So the question is, could we get this group together for another discussion in the next 2 days to finish these? We've gone through two, probably the meatiest one, this one we just have three more.
If I can fit it in, I'll certainly cooperate with that, John. I would like to make a suggestion with regard to the medias one, though.
Yes.
And that is that we go ahead and proceed and try and get something out to the list this week. And if Margie will draft that, and we can take a quick look at that on the list and get it out to the community working group list for their review and not wait till we get the others done. Does that make sense?
I think that's great. If Margie maybe could draft the first one, and then I think Richard probably had the best, or at least what sounded like a coherent start of a statement on the second one. So maybe, Richard, would you be willing to pull a statement together on that?
Yeah, I'll take a first cut.
Okay, so let's circulate those to this smaller group first. Some comments on that, and then we could bring it out to the larger group. But at the same time, is Gisella on the call? Or Margie, if you could coordinate with Gisella or Glenn to roll for the next 2 days, hopefully before the Thanksgiving in the U.S., because it looks like there are a fair amount of Americans on here. That would be helpful.
Sure. Gisela, I think you're on, right? Gisela or Glenn? I think we should send Gisela around immediately for tomorrow.
Hi, Margie.
Sorry, it's Gisela. I'm on the call. It's okay. I'll send out a doodle for Tuesday or Wednesday.
Tuesday or Wednesday. Quick doodle. That'd be great.
And,
okay.
And is it realistic to get the for Margie and Richard to get out their suggested wording on the first two by as early as possible tomorrow, and for this group then to respond so that we could get something out to the community working group by Wednesday?
From my perspective, yes.
Richard?
Yeah.
Perfect. Okay. All right, so we'll look for the doodle, we'll look for the statement from Margie, the statement from Richard, and we'll be back in touch hopefully in the next couple of days.
Thank you.
Thanks, John.
Thanks, John.
And Margie.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.